For both Claudia and Shepard, they never expected their lives to take any dramatic turns. But a night of chaos and trauma sets these two wayward ships afloat in a tumultuous sea. Alone, they may drown, but together, they might just be able to bring themselves to safe harbor. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. Today's daring dive brings us to Haven by Rebecca Weatherspoon. This is another one of those novels that went into the shopping cart without knowing anything about it, the writer or the publisher. I found it while I was placing the order for Master of the Mountain from the last episode, and the algorithm had decided that it was similar enough taste-wise to suggest it to me. And I'm really glad I stumbled upon this author. I really suggest heading over to Weatherspoon's website because it's fun and colorful and practically sweet. Looking at a few of her books and their descriptions, I think I'll really have to visit her work again in the future. In fact, I probably already decided the next book from her that I will visit for the podcast. She appears to be a very diverse writer, at least that's what on her website. She's covered everything from fluff to plus size to POC characters to paranormal to BDSM. And the latter category is what brought us here today with Haven. Haven is the first book in the Beards and Bondage series. It's pretty self-explanatory in what we are about to find in today's selection. Real quick, if you missed the last episode and maybe want a quick rundown on a BDSM as a concept, I'd recommend you listen to the first part of episode 19 for some definitions. And just like last time, BDSM as a concept can touch on some topics that might affect survivors of abusive relationships or violence, and today's novel also covers some deep, violent trauma, so keep that in mind as we go forward. Our journey into Haven will begin with its cover. The big defining feature of the cover is most definitely the image of a shirtless and muscular man. I won't say jacked, he's just slightly too soft for that designation, but the veins on his arms are still pretty three-dimensional. I will note that we can't see the upper half of his face. We get a clear view of his chin and, therefore, his beard, but that's about all we can see. While his body is the main focus, we can see the suggestions of a forested mountainside behind him. Down below where the author's name and book title are printed, we can see pine trees poking out of a foggy mist. And a snow-capped mountain climbs behind him. What's especially interesting is this effect of a double exposure, where we can see the jagged peaks of the mountains overlaid on his right arm. Personally, this is probably one of my favorite covers in a long while. Inside the pages, we meet Shepard Olson, and we get something completely different right out of the gate. Our novel is written in the first person. Up until now, we've been reading novels in third person limited for the most part, basically all of them, which is why I never mention it. Third-person limited POV is simply the perspective of one character at a time, where we are limited only to that character's thoughts and experiences. This can be contrasted with third-person omniscient, where the narrator knows everything going on with everyone. However, with limited, while we might be privy to only one character's thoughts at a time, we can gain a wider perspective of what's happening in the story. Take, well, any of the novels that we've looked at on the podcast. Any of those stories could have had a different mood or tone if we didn't have the benefit of third person limited. We can see character A's responses and reactions to the story around them, while at the same time watching things that character A might not necessarily see at first, including the motives and intentions of character B. As far as this relates to romance novels, this helps us cheer for our intended couples. We know the honest feelings of each character, but can also see what forces and obstacles lie in their path. The characters can gain our trust because we have an objective view of their limited experience. It is also simple for a writer to switch perspectives when working in third-person limited. Thus, it is a popular choice for our romance genre. First-person might seem similar in a way, but in reality it's completely different. For starters, our view has become narrower. We are now only limited to exactly what each character sees, and how they experience events around them. We also can't exactly trust the narrator. We need to consider the concept of an unreliable narrator. When we think about ourselves and how we see ourselves, it's not always the reality of our true self. A narcissist might always feel justified in their actions when they cause harm to the people around them, even if they truly believe that they are doing good. These narrators can leave things out to tell the story as they want to tell it in order to gain our acceptance as readers. First person is not a bad choice for narration, of course not. Some of the most famous stories are written in first person, and there are excellent examples of the unreliable narrator among their number. But because we can't be sure if we can fully trust our narrator, it's an interesting choice for a romance novel. Personally, I don't think that it will matter much in the large scheme of things as far as this particular novel is concerned. It may simply be a stylistic choice by the author, and nothing much more than that. So with that in mind, we can really get started. We see Shep as he readies for bed, after returning home from a weekend out at a club named Mistress Evelyn's in Los Angeles. In an unusual start to these sorts of stories, he's not only been at a club, but with a woman, and to one whom it seems he will be returning to in a year's time. Looks like he's got an agreement with a couple or a poly group to visit and have some playtime once a year. Typically, our heroes will come more or less unattached. There might be an ex or a late partner that they're hung up on, but this is the first time we see a guy with, albeit a highly casual attachment. It remains to be seen if this alters or changes anything. For all we know, this could be the beginnings of a potential poly setup, and BDSM and poly tends to overlap as far as relationships go, but I'm not going to bet the farm on it. Shep is getting one last picture from his weekend fling when he hears a scream for help outside. He's out in the middle of nowhere, so it's especially troubling. Grabbing his gun, he opens his door to see a woman panicked and bleeding, begging for help. Moments later, he sees her attacker come out of the trees, and he pushes her behind him. The warning shot fails to stop the man, but the second shot doesn't miss. The woman passes out, and now he has to deal with her and the fact that he's got a dead man on his property. As he frantically drives down the mountain, the woman wakes up, disoriented and frightened. But Shep gets more information out of her. There were at least two attackers, and they killed her brother. Finally, he gets her name, Claudia, and goes over what hurts and where. He gets her to the ER, where we can see that small town thing everyone knows, everyone charms, Sparkle. Heck, I feel like it practically shines in this book. While there is some telling instead of showing, Shep's interactions with everyone feels genuine, from the ER orderly to the doctor to the sheriff. It's thanks to that small town energy that the ER folks let Shep in to see Claudia when she's awake. They know him. Any other hospital in a bigger city or even town might not have even considered it. Claudia is shaken, clearly, but Shep is already becoming steady land amongst a raging sea of chaos. I slide closer, pissed for some reason that I can't touch her. I barely know her. I don't know her at all. It's gonna be okay. You're safe now.
I ran. I just left him.
Claudia, look at me. She listens, turning her head the little bit that she can. Her hazel eye, the one that isn't swelling shut, is big and bloodshot, but it is the most beautiful eye I'm pretty sure I've ever seen. I'm gonna stay here with you until we find out what your brother is, okay? I'm not going anywhere. I can see the whisper of spark of something at work here, but that's not a total surprise. We're working with a romance novel, after all. And it's possible that their shared trauma might have created an unexpected connection between the two of them. Later, Shep is, obviously, summoned by the police, and the folks in blue have more than a few questions for him. They sit him down at the station and get his side of the story. It's confirmed that Claudia's brother was killed, and that they managed to catch the second killer. Shep isn't allowed home while forensics do their work, but he returns to get his dog Titus, and leaves to stay at a nearby friend's place, some folks named Jad and Maybell. It's the kind of tragedy that'll shake up a small town, so when Shep heads into town for the local diner, folks stare at him far more than they usually would. In the diner, he meets up with Will, one of the boys on the force. Shep gets some info he probably shouldn't have, that the two attackers may have been doing this for a while, and Shep's actions likely have saved more lives. Will also tells him that Claudia was awake and asking for him. Right out of the gate, Shep doesn't want to push her for anything, but it's clear she needs some company, or at least a somewhat familiar face, while she's being bombarded by police and FBI and doctors. They talk, and the tragedy deepens for Claudia. Her brother had just finished his medical residency, and while Claudia wasn't much of an outdoorsman, she wanted to catch up with her brother, since he'd been so busy with medical school. He was the one who had suggested the camping trip. With the past loss of her parents years ago, Claudia was now on her own, something that she has in common with Shep. He cracks a soft joke that every situation could be worse, and in her case, it could have been clowns instead of just some scumbags. The joke does its job, though, and gets her to laugh, which breaks the glass wall holding her emotions back, and the tears start flowing. But Shep isn't going to leave her alone with her anguish.
I know we just met, but do you want me to hold you? I'll do it happily. I'm only asking because I want it to be your choice. I figure you might do with some comforting, I say. Please. There's no room on that hospital bed for me, period, but I gently move her IV stand and lift her into my lap. She lightly rests her head on my chest and cries.
This is a good moment, one that I like to see because it establishes Shep as a safe person. He has enough emotional intelligence to know that she might need some physical comfort, but is also acutely aware that she might not want to be touched at all, if ever. His request does wonders to show us that he wants to do right by her, and wants to gain her consent before ever having any physical contact, platonic or otherwise. The two of them fall asleep, and then they are rudely woken up by arriving FBI, who were demanding to know why Shep was allowed in the room in the first place. I mean, fair. All the small-town charm in the world won't save you from the ever-scrutinizing eye of the feds. Might make it even worse if I think about it. So the feds take him down to the sheriff's station for another grilling session, but because we know he's the good guy, his story doesn't change. They let him go, but not back to his house just yet. He has to keep staying with his friends for now because they have to sweep it for evidence, and he's definitely not allowed to see Claudia again. 3 days go by, and we can see Shep struggling with the aftermath of the events. He can't sleep. He sees the man he shot in his mind constantly, and his friends always are reassuring him that he stopped a monster. It's interesting that they're touching on this particular plot point at the beginning. For folks like me who like a good damsel in distress narrative, it's typical for us to expect the explosive conflict at the end of the story, the challenge that our heroes must overcome so that they could be together at last. But Shep and Claudia have never met each other before this encounter. We don't get that narrative tension of wondering whether or not they'll finally be able to be together after a whole novel of romantic angst. But as a trade, we get what we usually don't in those happily ever afters, and that's the potential PTSD that can stem from a violent encounter. Looking at a story like The Negotiator from Episode 8, we had the kill or be killed last minute battle with no falling action. We don't know the after effects of dealing with kidnapping and lethal self-defense. Essentially, the story just ended. We will have to see how this added complication might play out with our pair here. Shep ends up in town again, and inside the diner he runs into the feds. Clearly, the small-towners are fed up with the agents and are more than ready to throw them out. They tell Shep that they're done sweeping his house and truck for evidence and that he can have both back. On his way to get his truck, he stops by the hospital, where he finds that Claudia has already left, but did write him a note. The note sums up two certainties. She says she'll never leave the city again, and how thankful she was that he was home that night. What she doesn't leave is a way to contact her, and Shep takes it like a champ. It looks like he was hoping to keep connected, but he respects her choice to move on. The perspective now shifts to Claudia. She's back home in New York, and she's taking it one day at a time. The timeline moves forward pretty quickly. We see her first day back home, where she's comforted by her friend Liz and frustrated by her boyfriend Jason. Her emotions are obviously all over the place, and in that first week, there's not a lot that can be done for the raw guilt and grief she's experiencing. Month 4 pops up next, and she's finally gotten her brother's remains back. It's a long, hard road as she makes arrangements for a funeral, but she is determined to see herself through to the other side. In month 6, she is starting to make bigger moves. She's been seeing a therapist, albeit one she doesn't like that much, dumped her boyfriend for being an idiot, and is considering quitting her job. The therapist suggests a good break, since she hadn't had one since the funeral, but Claudia knows she's really not coping well. And through this chapter, her mind keeps going back to Shep. She tries to push the thoughts away, but she still finds herself wishing for the comfort Shep gave her when he rescued her. It makes sense. He was, forgive me for this, a haven for when her life was in mortal danger, and he provided the first security she got after the murder attempt. Her mind probably wants that safety and stability in her daily life as she struggles to right herself. Every day has been a battle, and she is yearning for calm. Moving back to Shep's perspective, he returns home from his work as a photographer. He gets a call from Connie at the diner. Claudia has appeared, it seemed, and was asking for him. She's not at the diner anymore, though, but he gets word that she is staying at a local cabin lodge. After the clerk lets Claudia know Shep was here, she meets him down in the lobby, where he gets his first actual good look at her without any bruises, bandages, or cuts. She looks different than I remember, but I know it's her. At the time, I was more concerned with her living through the night than I was with her looks, but Caleb wasn't wrong. She's hot as fuck. She's shorter than me, like most everyone in a 100-mile radius, but she's not very short. She's wearing tark-dyed pants, some high tan boots, and one of those puffer winter jackets with a fur-lined hood that somehow manages to hug her tits and her waist. She has makeup on, but she doesn't need it. Her hazel eyes and her lips speak for themselves. She's carrying a bouquet of roses. "Hi," she says. That's her voice, my brain tells me. I've only heard it a handful of times, but it's burned into my memory along with other things from that night. I'm not sure how to put this any other way, but this passage is very male-gazy. We see Claudia through his eyes, and the first-person narrative does Shep a disservice, I think. Two qualities that he comments on stick out at me. First, about that jacket. A puffy jacket that is tailored for women is, surprise, good at accentuating a woman's figure. I'm not sure why he's perplexed by this. Anyway, the second point is he says she doesn't need makeup, and this is a scenario that is borderline cliché. I know what's happening here. We have found a man who does not base his opinion of a woman on how well she can present herself in public. I have seen this before. Male romantic heroes always insisting that their women don't need makeup. I think it's intended as empowerment, but it doesn't really do anything for me. It just smells ever so slightly of so-called nice guys. I'm not saying Shep is bad here, but I think we are a little too inside his head for these moments. He has another one like this, where they arrive at the restaurant. She has taken off her jacket, and it looks like she is rocking some cleavage. Shep tells us that she looks so good, even if she were his, he wouldn't tell her to cover up. So what are you saying here, Shep? If her cleavage was less than satisfactory, would you insist that she keep her jacket on as some sort of claim to her? Is it just perfect enough that her breasts are so magnificent you don't feel the need to have some control over her body? I do realize that we are reading a BDSM novel and that domination and submission plays with power dynamics, but this ain't it, Chief. He does redeem himself by clarifying that it wasn't misogyny that made him order a beer for her. It was simply that the place just didn't have anything fancier than what he ordered. Glad we cleared that up. To his credit, he is genuinely respectful of her boundaries as they talk at the table. One part of the conversation is a little bit of getting to know one another, and another part is how they've been coping with the after of their ordeal. And it is safe to say that neither one of them is coping well at all. Shep can tell that there is more that Claudia wants to say, but she insists that what she wants is selfish and delusional, so there's no point in voicing whatever it is that's bothering her. They finish up their drinks, and Shep drops her back off at the motel lodge and gives her his number properly this time. As he's driving back to his house, she calls him, sobbing, asking why he didn't look for her. He's honest with her, tells her that the note read to him like a final thank you and a goodbye. That the lack of any means to contact her made it clear to him that she wanted to move on. As much as he wanted to be there for her, to protect her, he knew that showing up in her life suddenly would not have been the best of ideas for either of them. She sees his logic and asks him to stay with her. He tells her that he has a dog, so she asks to come with him to his house. He's not sure if this is the right move, considering his home does not have any positive associations for her, but does agree. They arrive at his house. Claudia is introduced to Titus, and they start talking. Really talking. They both agree to be completely honest with one another, and they get to the root about what's been eating at them most. For Claudia, she's been worried that she's been developing a sort of dependency on Shep, that when she comforts herself, she imagines him holding her. For Shep, he's been considering going down to LA for a week of relaxing BDSM domination. He's specifically been fantasizing about dominating her, but he's not dumb enough to even suggest the possibility. She does, though. She suggests that they spend the night cuddling, and tomorrow they can explore spicier options. He agrees to the cuddling, but nothing more than that. The next morning is when the negotiations start. Claudia tells him that she actually likes it a bit rough in the bedroom, and her boyfriend was ignoring her needs after the ordeal. Shep had told her that he usually goes to LA for a week to enjoy some dom time, so she offers to give him a week. She's already alerted her friends to her whereabouts, and she's asked for the week to begin immediately, so the ball was fully in Shep's court. He considers what she's offering, and takes the ball and runs with it. He offers first that they go get breakfast in town, head back to her cabin at the lodge, knock boots, and after that they can decide to go all in with the week of debauchery. Claudia agrees, and he walks into dom mode. While Claudia seems to be a masochist of sorts, that being a bottom who likes to be hit or roughly handled, Shep is more formal domination, but he's happy to provide what she's asking for. So on top of the rough sex that she wants, he will walk into the BDSM role that he has been needing. Before they stop at the lodge, they get breakfast at the diner. They sit in the far back corner in a booth with tall seats that basically shields them from sight. This is important because Shep orders Claudia to pull down her shirt and expose her breasts. I think I forgot to mention that before they left, he has instructed her to leave off her underwear and a bra, so she is flying free right now. This is another moment where we need to remind ourselves that this is fiction. It is exaggerated for the purpose of the story as an erotic romance novel. But while Claudia isn't unfamiliar with BDSM as a concept, asking to expose herself in public, no matter how hidden they are, is a real 0 to 100 move. At least for me, it's not something I would be down for. Hell, I wouldn't even let a theoretical dom demand that I can't wear a bra outside. These girls are heavy and my back hurts. This can also bring up the question of consent. Sure, Claudia has consented to BDSM play, Shep has consented, but no one else in this diner has consented to this. I've seen this argument, whether or not individuals in the kink community should be waving their freak flag as high as we've seen some folks do. On one side of the argument, we have people saying that they are consenting adults, that they aren't hurting anyone, and that they can do what they like. The other side brings up the consent issue. No one else around them consented to a display of their kink, therefore, they should not bring their play into public spaces. It might seem prudish of me, but even as sex positive as I am, I'm somewhere in the second camp. I know that there are small signs that BDSMers use to fly under the radar, like handkerchiefs and collars that look like jewelry, and I'm not saying that these things shouldn't be used, but dragging your puppy play submissive down the sidewalk on a leash is not the best way to meet the neighbors. Mild PDA is fine, but don't take it further than that, I think, in most general situations. And Shep can take as many precautions as he likes, but anything can happen outside. Like, say, a small child hyped up on syrup running around too quickly for Shep to warn Claudia to cover up. That doesn't happen in the story, I'm just presenting it as a what-if. Breakfast is finished, and they all but break down the door of Claudia's cabin, eager to get going. And it is fast and urgent. Claudia strips instantly, Shep following suit, and when Claudia tries to lay on the bed, he orders her to stand in front of him. He teases her, but not kindly, I guess you could say. He puts her hand around her throat and orders her to touch him. When he's had enough of his fun, he grabs the chair in the room, sits, and has her straddle him. And if Master of the Mountain was descriptive, it's taken one step further here. I'd say the author was working to make sure that we were inside Shep's mind so we get some words we might not usually in different novels. Cunt is the big one here, not a word that I think I've seen before. I'm not opposed to its use, but it is a tad jarring compared to pussy. But it makes sense because it comes from Shep himself. It matches up with his vernacular and his propensity to use crasser words when he describes Claudia's body, so it makes sense from a narrative standpoint. Now, about that chair. It can't handle the weight of them together, so the legs snap, but it looks like Shep was waiting for it. He catches them both, making sure Claudia doesn't fall off his dick, and walks them over to the bed. He must be truly jacked, and she must weigh nothing, because I can't see that working out well for most couples. Disappointingly, though, this is another situation where there's not much other additional stimulation. He plays with her nipples a bit, but he doesn't make use of the highly available nerve endings in her clit, and she comes from his dick alone. The world needs to know where we can find these men with their magical orgasmic dicks. Apparently, there must be a lot of them. After they're done, it's officially decided that Claudia will stay the week with Shep, so they check her out of the hotel and head back up the mountain. They find Maybell waiting for them at Shep's house. She's heard from Connie at the diner that Shep has had a lady friend, and not just any lady friend, the lady friend that he rescued 6 months ago. She leaves him with a stern, "Don't be stupid," and heads out. Shortly after, Claudia has gotten a phone call from Liz, her best friend. Liz is the kind of friend we all need because she demands Shep give his address, a picture of his license, and photos of him and Claudia together so that she knows that her friend is okay. It seems like Claudia was vague on the details of her California trip, and Liz isn't happy about it. After he happily complies with Liz's requests, he gently scolds Claudia for being so rash. He knows he's fine, we know he's fine, but Claudia didn't necessarily know that he was fine. She could have gotten into some serious trouble running away to the man who lives by himself alone with his dog on the mountain. A few interactions with Claudia as she teases him before hopping in the shower gets Shep in a strange headspace. When Claudia is done in the shower, he tells her that he's a little unsteady, since he's used to a submissive in LA who is a 24-hour sub with 10 years of BDSM experience. His ex, however, was only doing the submissive routine because she only wanted to go along with what made him happy. Obviously, the relationship fell apart, and Shep's concerned that Claudia was doing the same thing, submitting because he asked, not because she wants to submit. She steps in front of me and puts her hand on my chest.
"If you did believe that I wanted you to dominate me, what would you do to me right now?"
"I figure I might as well tell the truth. There is no harm in hypotheticals. I'd have you get on your knees right now and I'd fuck your mouth."
"Okay."
I watch Claudia as she pulls the towel off her hair and starts to fold it in half. She folds it in half again. She steps back just enough to place it on the floor. Then she kneels in front of me.
"You were saying?"
There is a lot of open and honest communication happening here, even more so than the novels we've read with higher communication levels than others. Shep and Claudia aren't holding much of anything back in their dance, and it's quite refreshing. The perspective shifts to Claudia as Shep delivers the promised throat fucking. She admits to herself that she's really not sure how to submit correctly, but she is here for whatever Shep wants to throw at her. There's a brief mention of a safe word, and Shep plays up the dom aspect. He says no, she won't need it because she loves it so much, and he'll keep going anyway. But if she has his dick in her mouth, the safe word is a little tricky to work with anyway. So he tells her that if she needs to stop, pinch him in the leg. It's a good balance of playing the role and giving the way out if needed. Well done. She has a mild moment of panic when she starts to get overwhelmed, but like a good dom, Shep checks in with her, reassures her, balances her, and they go on. Again, this first-person perspective is interesting. From Claudia's viewpoint, we can see how enthusiastic she is about giving head. She practically revels in it. But she's also a little unbalanced, since giving head and being throat-fucked are two slightly different concepts, but she is not complaining at all. After he comes, he makes sure that he does right by her and gives her some mind-blowing oral sex after a small spat of spanking. He's almost methodical about it, telling her to clean up when he's done and then heads out to make them dinner. After dinner, we have more communication. Shep stepped outside a moment to let Titus out, and in the few minutes that he was outside, Claudia became irrationally afraid that something had happened and she'd be alone on the mountain. It's a scary moment for her, but Shep gets her talking, to work it out. Then he asks what she truly wants.
"I want you to hurt me. I want you to degrade me. I want you to turn me into a nothing little slut and then build me back up again. I want to feel something that isn't this for as long as possible. I need something to break. I need something in me to finally shatter. I couldn't get myself there at home and everyone around me was all about pushing me forward, but you can give me this. I know you can. It still doesn't make it okay for me to ask you to do it.
This honesty is direct and cutting, and I'm glad that we aren't just getting a happy little story that's full of sexy romps in the woods. We are getting a brutal reality with the notion that emotions are not always rational, and we need to find ways to express ourselves and find outlets that allow us to sort out these emotions. Right now, for Claudia, that outlet is sexual in nature and degrading in practice. You'll notice that she talked about being built back up again. I've seen this theme in BDSM works. The dom can pick the submissive apart bit by bit, but they are always careful about putting them back together. I'm going to go ahead and label a trope that I know will be a recurring theme, and that will be better mental health through BDSM. It's a little wordy, but I have seen it over and over again. After her declaration, Shep ties Claudia's hands behind her back, literally cuts her clothes off of her, and has his way with her. After that, their night is pretty normal. Take the dog out, watch a movie, make out, have sex, bedtime. The next morning, Shep brings Claudia with him when he takes Titus out for a walk, and their conversation is incredibly natural. I can practically hear Claudia when she says, "What in sweet nature, man, hell," in response to Shep knowing the mountain like the back of his hand. It's a bold move on Shep's part, though. The last time Claudia was out in the woods like this, her brother was murdered and she was nearly killed. It's clear that she's tense, but she pushes on, taking in the sights she knew her brother wanted her to see. On their walk, Shep also has a list of get-to-know-you questions. Birthdays, family, all that good stuff. Clearly, they are enjoying each other's company. Back at the house, they try to have more sex, but they get interrupted by Jad, asking to borrow Shep's chainsaw. He says he's not meddling, but I'm not convinced. He gets the chainsaw and invited Shep and Claudia to dinner with him and Maybell that night. They go and dinner does not go well. Shep and Jad get into a fight about what Shep is doing, how it's not exactly healthy. He has a few points, but Shep is his own person, whether Jad likes it or not. Jad brings up old wounds with Shep's ex and his broken family dynamics. It's rough, and if I were in Claudia's shoes, I might try to burrow myself into the ground to escape the conflict. They leave, of course, and Shep decides to shelve the idea he had for a scene with Claudia. I love that the book takes the time to mention this, because he recognizes that the wrong headspace will at best ruin the scene and at worst hurt Claudia somehow. So they relax for the night and take time to chill the next day, until the very end of the night when Shep fulfills another request that Claudia had, and that was to come all over her back. He obliges but leaves Claudia hanging, so to speak. He knows what he's doing, being a strict dom with a sub working on her brat routine. So he's not neglecting her, just playing into the role. The next day is a Monday, and Shep has actual work that needs to be done. He needs to take some photographs for the Forest Service, and takes Claudia and Titus up with him on the mountain. She follows, with a mild moment of panic induced by running into two hikers on the trail, and afterwards they head into town to pick up some dinner and a few things at the post office, namely, things that Shep had ordered for all of their kinky needs. When they get back to the house, they make good use of all those toys. A ball gag, a flogger, restraints, even a butt plug. Shep goes all in, and Claudia is enthusiastic in her submission. Although, she gets a taste of something called subdrop, basically what happens when the endorphins and hormones that built up and exploded during a scene basically check out. A little bit like a sugar crash, but with emotional upheaval. She's still feeling it as they head out early the next morning for Shep to take his pictures. And something happens that we've never seen before until now. Claudia teases him, asks him to sex her up against a tree, and has a moment of panic again during the act when she notices the gun that he takes for protection against, you know, bears, is out on the ground and out of his hands. He stops when she says stop and picks up the gun at her urging, and they head home. This is such an important moment. I remember when I was in high school, I heard the myth that men were basically mindless animals, and that once they got to a certain point during sex, they could not stop. I can't even begin to describe how damaging that was. First, it was meant as a way to scare girls into not having sex, of course, but more so it insulted an entire gender, calling them brainless and without any self-control. But Shep stops when she says stop. End of story. It's powerful, and we really need to see more of it in media. On their way back to the house, Claudia can't help herself but run into the cabin, racing with Titus. It's not a moment of fear, but a moment of release. She enjoys the exertion of the run, and it's a good thing she ran too, because back at the cabin she's got cell service again, and that's when she gets a phone call from a bigwig in the New York fashion world, with an offer that Claudia would be stupid to turn down. Big problem, though. She has to be back in New York the next day in order to seal the deal. Our third act separation has poked its way into our Kinky Mountain fantasy. It's heart-wrenching goodbye, probably the most real goodbye we've ever seen. There's a declaration of love, taking on guilt, shouting. It's raw, and sometimes we need a raw slice of emotion to connect us to these characters. Shep doesn't take the breakup well, if we can call a weekend and some change worthy of a breakup. He wanders around numb, and Jad checks in on him after a couple of days. He apologizes how dinner went with Claudia, and that's not an excuse that he was just looking out for Shep. A month and a half later, we meet up with Claudia. Liz tracks her down and promptly gives her the riot act for blowing her off constantly. Claudia can't help it anymore, and tells Liz most everything about what happened on the mountain, about how much she fell for Shep and her need to get her emotions under control, and, most importantly, how Shep was there when those emotions ran amok. Or maybe we can talk about how I lost my shit up there like a minimum of 5 times, and he handled it perfectly. And I'm not talking like a perfect medical professional. I'm talking marriage material. This is how you want a man to hold you for the rest of your life type shit. Like, you know he can handle anything you throw at him. Calm and cool. Liz again shines as the best friend we all need. She gives it to Claudia straight. Shep probably has feelings for her, but the real important thing is that Claudia needs to sort herself out. Get a new therapist that will jive, and work on her mental health properly. She also tells her to never ever quit a job for a man, but the rest she'll leave up for Claudia. Back up at the mountain, Shep gets a call. Connie from the diner tells him that Claudia has showed up, and does he want to send Claudia up his way, or will he come to the diner to see her? He takes option 2, freaks himself out that he got her pregnant, and basically speeds down the mountain. Claudia doesn't beat around the bush. She loves him, and she's hoping that he still loves her too. She proposes to him, though there isn't a ring, and explains that how things have come into focus since she left, that she doesn't have to quit her job, and can spend time in the mountains and in New York, guessing that Shep does enjoy his solitude from time to time. He fakes her out for a second, gets up like he's leaving, and then calls out for her to follow him to the cabin. The ending is very cathartic, that's for sure, so what else do we think of Haven? Well, you've already heard me go on about the first-person perspective, so I won't say much more on it, but it really shook up the writing styles we've been experiencing. On the one hand, I loved being able to see everything with the characters as they saw it, but on the other, I'm not sure I fully enjoyed being that inside their heads. Shep had the perspective of a vast majority of the time, which is also interesting. Not that I'm generalizing anything, but erotic literature is skewed towards a female-presenting audience, so it's a surprise that we see everything through the man's eyes. There's something to be said about male gaze, but perhaps it was a way to help the reader feel that the heroine was being viewed as honestly as possible by the hero. It also felt like a blink-and-you'll-miss-it kind of book, at least half of it. The first half had a slow start, but once Shep and Claudia started getting it on, I felt as though the story flew by. 1 minute they are laying out ground rules for the week, next minute she has to run back to New York. That's my perspective anyway. But for the rest of it, let's get into Heather's final score. The cover first as always, and that is going to get a 5 out of 5. I actually really love this cover. I love the double exposure effect of the mountain and the man together, how his skin pops out over the muted grays of the misty forest. This is one of those moments when the cover knows what it is about and flaunting it. Drama will get a 4 out of 5. You can't really beat a dramatic moment like finding a woman running away from a murderer and in the forest and shooting him dead to save her. And moreover, we have the aftermath to deal with. The emotional stakes were incredibly high. Probably one of the reasons that this book felt like a quick read was because it gripped me with the what next approach. Romance, well, I think I'll give it a 3 out of 5. Claudia and Shep really only knew each other for about the span of a week, give or take, when we look at the total time spent with one another. It's a fast romance, and the question of is this love or dependency is brought up. I felt that they had a lot of sexual chemistry, but romantic chemistry is hard to pinpoint. And I will bring up to the point that what Claudia did was extremely dangerous. Do not throw yourself at a man who lives alone up on a mountain just because he saved your damn life. I don't care how sexy he is, don't do it. Remember, this is fiction. Spice Level, though, gets that coveted 5 out of 5. Even if they didn't get into the hard BDSM with flogging and major restraints until the very end, they had no problem living it up sexually. Like I said, they had a lot of sexual chemistry, and the narration was not skimpy on those details. Shep also made a point about walking Claudia through every step of BDSM, ensuring trust, and giving her as much agency as he could. Safe sex can also be spicy sex. Realism is an interesting one, though. The whole conceptual setup, totally bonkers. However, the book touches on a lot of real-life topics. Mental health, trauma, broken families, the whole gambit. If the last book, Master of the Mountain, was a therapy speedrun, this book is a demonstration on why mental health and good therapy is important. Claudia mentions that her first therapist didn't jive with her, so she got a new one. She becomes aware that she is not processing her trauma as well as she should. Shep is honest with her about his past and his worries about their time together. I thought these topics were handled very well and didn't cross into hokey territory. There was also a small theme of climate change that ran in the background, and any time that gets brought up, I'll give a thumbs up. So realism is going to get a 4 out of 5. So in the end, what can I say about Haven? Well, it made me laugh, cry, and delivered on a realistic sexual relationship. I wholly enjoyed it, even if I was a little put off by the first-person perspective, and I know I'm going to be reading more from this author very soon. For my final score, Haven will get 4 cranky wilderness photographers out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwangyun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And remember that it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.